Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, listeners. This is NWT Radio, a production of the National Writing Project. Today is February 13, 2014, and tonight we're talking with Ninu Rami. I'm your host, Tammy Baker, at the NWT in Berkeley, California. Ninu, a high school English teacher at Science Leadership Academy in Philadelphia, a Philadelphia Writing Project teacher consultant, and the founder of NCAP, has just authored Thrive, 5 Ways to Reinvigorate Your Teaching. Tonight, we'll talk with Ninu about all things teaching, learning, and connecting. Tonight's show is a pre-record, but if you are listening to us at airtime, we invite you to join us in the chat room, where we will be posting links to materials related to tonight's program. Ninu, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you. I really appreciate this opportunity.
I'm really excited to talk to you about this book. I think Writing Project teachers everywhere are going to love it. The book, in part, is a narrative that describes how you've gone from wanting to merely survive the struggles of the classroom in your first year to really having ideas about how to thrive as an educator. What does it feel like to tell that story? And who do you think is your ideal audience, Ninu?
So I think, when I first approached about possibly writing this book by Toby and Teo, an editor at Heinemann, I was like, really? Me? Like, you want to write about ways to thrive in the classroom? I'm like a seventh-year teacher from Philadelphia. Like, what do I know? so it has been at once very humbling and I'm very grateful for this opportunity to share my story. I think what's interesting about my story is I feel like a lot of people come to the point where I was in my career, and I think a lot of people can get to the point where I am in my career, and this is what I mean by that. I think a lot of us enter the classroom with a ton of hope, a ton of positivity, a ton of desire to make a difference in the world and reach kids and affect the world in a positive way. And once you actually get there, once you actually cross that threshold of your first classroom, sometimes the realities can hit you like a ton of bricks, and you run into a ton of challenges that may even break your spirits at times. And I feel like by doing some of the book, some of the things that are suggested in the book, I was able to go from like, oh my God, what did I get myself into? How did I get here? To like, for like I say in the introduction, for the most part, on most days, I can't wait to get out of bed and go back to the work that I have started with my students. I'm energized by them. I'm energized by my colleagues, by people I know in my daily life and through my online network. And I'm excited about the work that's happening in my life and the work that I'm doing with my students. So I think it's humbling, but I think it's also an important teacher narrative that needs to be shared at this particular moment in our lives as teachers. I feel like the public discourse around teaching is very negative and very one-sided. I feel like people who are making the decisions about what it means to be a teacher and how it affects students' learning actually haven't spent much time in the classroom. So I feel like in my small effort, in my humble effort, I am trying to provide a different narrative about what it means to be a teacher in 2014, and what are some of the challenges that one faces, and what are some of the joys and energizing moments of that experience.
That's really lovely and well said, Ninu, and I don't know if I would call your effort humble or small, though I'm sure you're very humble about it. But I agree with you that it challenges, it complexifies the teacher narrative that's going on in the world right now, and I think gives responsibility for it back to teachers in a way that's really important, and that's what I love about this book. The book, as the title would suggest, gives you sort of five big suggestions about how to reinvigorate our teaching, and we'll spend a little time with each of the suggestions that you made today. So the first thing you tell us is that we should turn to mentors. So I wonder if you could start by, a lot of people are going to get this advice particularly early in their career, and I'm wondering if you can describe for our audience your first mentoring experience with a school-assigned mentor.
Sure. I started teaching in 2006. I was 26 years old, so I was in like, you know, 21 or 22 entering the classroom. And at the time, the school district of Philadelphia could actually afford this. Each new teacher in the district was given a teacher coach. So I had a teacher coach as a brand new teacher in the district. And I remember, you know, every, I think, you know, Thursday was our, like, set date, and every few weeks she would come by and see me in action. And I remember I was teaching House on Mango Street, Sandra Cisneros' work, to like ninth graders, and we were working on writing our own vignettes, and I was stumbling, I was, you know, struggling, I was trying to figure it out, I was trying to reach kids, I was trying to do so many different things at once, right, like a first year teacher might do. And I just didn't have that rapport. Even though, you know, I was clearly told that there would be no punitive, you know, outcomes from these observations. I couldn't make that connection, and build that trust where I could be like, you know, that's nothing on that woman. She was a lovely woman. She was very kind. She tried to help me. I think I just didn't feel safe. And I feel like a lot of new teachers can relate to that. You just don't know what. You're just so scared to fail in front of someone else. It's hard enough to fail in front of your kids when you're trying things, but it's even harder when someone else is watching you. So that was my first experience with a school assigned or district assigned mentor.
Yeah, I think you're right that a lot of us can relate to that experience. And you go on, and yet you go on to really gather mentors around you. You compare this, you know, assigned mentor relationship to what you refer to as a comprehensive package of mentoring. What's that look like?
I feel like you can't really, for lack of a better word, thrive unless you do collect a team of mentors around you, where you have a group of people who are cheering you on, especially early on when you're struggling and when you're facing a lot of challenges in the classroom. So I describe this in a couple of ways in the opening chapter of the book. I describe people who, you know, forced me to re-examine my current practice with new eyes, people who challenged me to try new work, people who helped me connect with larger community, people who helped me with my writing life, people who, you know, pushed me to share my work with a wider audience. I have these specific people or groups of people who, you know, whether they chose to be my mentors or not, you know, I've sort of been them. I don't know if they've ever accepted this, but I just keep coming back to them, you know, like an annoying kid who won't go away. Like, I just keep coming back to them, and I keep asking for questions, for help, for support. And I feel like that has really helped to push my work both in and out of the classroom. So I think for us, mentors can be people that are like right next door to you and who can provide maybe like institutional knowledge that you may not have if you're new to a school. For example, Alexa Dunn at Science Leadership Academy has done that for me when I joined that school. She was sort of my like in-house mentor. Like, how do I turn in grades? Like, what does it mean to have a conference? How do I run my advisory effectively? Those are the things that she was an expert at or was far, far better at than I was at that time. She helped me with those things. So she had the institutional knowledge that I didn't have. You know, and someone that I thank profusely in my book and mention again in my opening chapter as a mentor is Jim Burke. Like, Jim is a well-established author and speaker and teacher. He has helped me to see my own practice through, you know, someone who writes these types of books. So I don't see him every day. He's based in San Francisco. I'm based in Philadelphia. But, you know, whenever we do see each other, he makes time for me. He's willing to listen to my questions. He's willing to give me a long view of this career that I have as someone, you know, in my position at this point in my career. That would, you know, same would go for someone like Penny Kittle. Penny, again, is not anywhere near me. You know, she's in New Hampshire and I'm in Philadelphia. But anytime I text her, she responds. And having that kind of access to someone who is in love with the baby, someone who is much better at their work than I am, can not only be a source of inspiration, but it also helped me to push my practice to a new level. I think that relationship has to be safe, though. Like, with any of these people, I can be like, this isn't working. This isn't working in my writing life. This isn't working in my teaching life. This isn't working, you know, me. How do I go about changing that? And I feel like these mentors are willing to listen to me, are willing to make time, but also provide that safe space where I can be vulnerable. I don't think you can really have a mentoring relationship where you can't be vulnerable.
That's fantastic. And strangely, you are the second person who has mentioned Penny Kittle to me as their mentor today. So,
wow.
A shout out to Penny Kittle and her fantastic mentoring of all of us in our profession through her writing and her online presence and just her fantastic work.
No, her reach is wide and deep.
Yes, it is wide and deep. That's well said. So I just want to encapsulate a few things that I feel like you said, Mimi, that might not be obvious to people, particularly if they think about mentors as this person assigned to me by the district. So it seems to me like you're saying, you know, people might need a lot of mentors, but like no one person can be all the help you might need in your work, that a mentor can be right next door, but they can also be far away. That it's really important that you're able to be vulnerable in the relationship and that these relationships can change over time. Are those things all, like, does that feel like a fair encapsulation of your mentoring advice?
Yeah, I think it does.
That's great. Okay, so, Mino, I'm going to, if it's okay, I'm going to jump to your second piece of advice.
Sure.
Which is to join and build networks. And I thought we might just start by you talking us through sort of your overlapping multiple networks.
Sure. So I would say that I first understood the power of learning in a community, you know, through Philadelphia Writing Project and National Writing Project. And then that network brought me to places like NCT and Center for Teacher Quality. And then I found places like ACHAT, that is something that I have tried to create for teachers, and Jim Burke's like EC Ning, which, you know, I was very active in a few years ago, but haven't been as active recently. So I feel like experiencing the Summer Institute and the Philadelphia, not just Philadelphia Writing Teachers, National Writing Teachers will really, I think, relate to that, and this will resonate for them. Having that Summer Institute experience where it felt like a sort of homecoming, to come to a place where people were thinking deeply about teaching and learning, and what it meant to, you know, transform lives through writing and through reading. That was a very powerful experience for me. So I feel like I live among these networks, but then new ones keep popping up in my life. You know, this summer I'm going to be teaching a course at Arcadia. Students and professors from University of Pennsylvania are always in my classroom. So there are all these, like, different places where some I'm more connected to, some I'm less connected to, but all of these places offer me the opportunity to learn in a community, and I think that's a very powerful thing. I feel like I can leverage the expertise of these groups and not always have to start from scratch when I'm trying to solve a problem. And I feel like, you know, one of the most rewarding things that happens to me when I'm at conferences or when people tweet these things, it's like, you know, I love ACHAB because every week I learn something new because of something that someone else has shared. to me, that is one of the kindest and one of the nicest things for me to hear. Like at NCT, when people stop me in the hallways of the conference and say, "Hey, I know you from ACHAB." Like, it's just like this really nice thing that people are experiencing what I experienced through Philadelphia Writing Project, this opportunity to connect with other people in a meaningful way where the focus of that exchange was teaching and learning and the joy that we can share and the ways that we can overcome challenges that we all face.
I think that I know that listeners to our radio show will resonate with that story, Mina, because I'm sort of smiling from ear because it's my story, it's your story, it's for so many of us in the National Writing Project who had that Summer Institute experience that really made visible this idea of a learning community. But yet we know that teaching is a very isolating profession and some people don't choose to join networks. What do you think keeps people from joining networks?
You know, I feel like teachers are asked a lot. You know, like, you have to be an expert in the content, right? Like, so if you're teaching biology, you better know biology, right? If you're teaching British literature, you better know British literature. But you also have to be a nurse and a counselor, a mediator, a school parent to some. You better know how to use 16 different systems to take attendance and turn in grades. And file that like really strange piece of paper just that one time of the year. So I feel like as a teacher, you're asked to do a ton of things. Like, you better know what's the orderly way to clean out lockers is at the end of the year, and how do you get 33 kids to do that at the same time without making a mess. Like, you should know that as well. So I feel like, and let alone plan like advisory parties and, you know, organize dances and things like that. You better know that as well. So I feel like as teachers, we're asked a lot, and people feel like, oh God, it's one more thing. Like, why would I do that? It's like one more thing. But I feel like people who do put that extra effort to connect, to join, to participate, then walk away with the knowledge and the expertise of everyone else in that network. So, for example, if I don't know what's the best way to, like, teach SAT vocabulary, like, I might just, like, tweet out that question to the HR community. I bet I can get, like, 4 or 5 amazing ideas that I can try next week or try the very next day. And people share those experiences with me. People share those connections with me, and I think that's what the power of learning in a community is, that you're not relying just on your expertise or your knowledge. You're tapping into this accumulated knowledge. Like, we talk about, you know, I say this a lot. We talk about, you know, our legacies and our connections. We should have those same things in teaching, right? Like, we should have this like family tree of sort as teachers too, right? Like, you know, I was taught by this person, and then this person taught me, and then I passed that knowledge on to someone else. I feel like if we did more of that give and take as a profession, we would be better off, and we would be more empowered and energized rather than what a lot of us are feeling these days, which is depleted and not.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I think I learned that in the writing project, and it's been a staple of my working life ever since, the importance of the community in which I learn and work. I want to move on, Minu, but I think that our listeners would find me remiss as an interviewer if I didn't ask you to give us sort of a 2-minute story of EngChat, which is a different story where when you didn't see the network you needed, you created it. So do you think you could give us a 2-minute EngChat history?
Yeah, it can be even shorter than that. So, so EngChat started in 2010. At that time, people were using Twitter, and it was a very popular and still popular Twitter chat, which was EdChat. But there wasn't a Twitter chat that was specifically for English teachers. And I kept saying to people, like, hey, there should probably be a Twitter chat for English teachers. And people just got sick of me saying that all the time. And they were like, why don't you just do it, like, if you're so excited about it? And I'd be like, and again, like, when an editor from Heinemann approached me, I was like, me? Little me? Like, you know, I don't think I even had, like, 100 followers at that point. I was like, no one's going to do that. Come on, like, I can't do it. But they were like, no, if you keep talking about it, you better do it. And so
yeah.
I had just finished Summer Institute, and I had drunk the Kool-Aid. I was like, oh yeah, teacher leadership, teacher agency, teacher voice. Those were the things I was grappling with, what they meant and you know, how they shape one's life. And I was like, yeah, you know what? I am going to do that. I'm gonna try it. And if nothing comes out of it, oh, well, at least I'll have tried. So that's how HF came to me. And again, Jim Burke, I reached out to Jim because I had known his work through EC Ning, and I said, would you like to, you know, participate in this Twitter chat that I'm trying to do with Legend English teachers on Twitter? And he was like, yeah, this is a great opportunity for me to share my work and get the word out about my work. Why not? I'll do it. And then since he had, he had a wide audience, that sort of got the ball rolling. But I think one of the things I think that makes A-Chat, unique and special to me is that you don't have to be Jim Burke to host. Like, if you have a good idea, like, you know, I'll reach out to you if I feel like you're doing something interesting, or if someone tells me you're doing something interesting, someone says, hey, you should check out this person's work. Like, it's not based on how many followers you have. It's the work that you're doing in your classroom, which you should be sharing with others. That's the reason why you should host, and you should be celebrated, and your work should be celebrated. And that's really how it came to be. And then we got a website, and we started putting archives, and it has grown since. And people talk not just on Monday nights, but all the time, and share their practice and their inquiry. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty fabulous story. And I love how it's embedded in these other stories of networks of yours, and how they inform each other and sort of help you stand on the shoulders of others to move forward and then lift up other people and their work. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
But I'm going to move on because otherwise I could be here all night, which I know I can't. So I want to move on to chapter 3, which is my personal favorite, I guess. I don't know. I love them all. But this is actually a really nice set of advice you offer up for your colleagues' consideration. Chapter 3 is about keeping your work intellectually challenging. And I think that in large part, this is my favorite, A, because I think it's really important, and B, because I think it flies in the face of a lot of advice that we see teachers and administrators receive. So I want first, if you would, I also think that the way you frame the sort of change in your understanding of what it means to keep teaching intellectually interesting from how you enter the profession to where you get as a more mature teacher is really important. So I wonder if you could start by talking to us about that disconnect between where young teachers think they're going to find intellectual challenge and where they actually do.
So I'm so glad you picked up on this point, because I think it could be easily missed at the beginning of the chapter. But I feel like, when you start to teach, like, you have this, or at least I did. I'll speak from my experience, and maybe others, other teachers.
Well, certainly my experience as well.
Yeah, this will resonate for other teachers as well. I was an English and philosophy major in undergrad, and you know, I was by the time I graduated, I was reading some really, you know, heady continental philosophy, and you know, I was really into English in high school and in college, and I had a deep love for that world. And when I went into teaching, I went into this idea that, like, oh, like, I'm just going to have these cool, rich, intellectual conversations about ideas and amazing authors and philosophers, and, you know, I'm like, what better way to spend my life? And
right.
And I feel like that's a lot of what I still get to do, but the challenge is slightly different. I feel like now I have more of a bird's eye view of you know, what brings joy and energy to my work, which is focusing on the way my students learn, or focusing on the way my students think. And it's not, the content is important, yes. I think when you choose content that speaks to the lives and experiences of the students in front of you, and you can only do that if you know your students. Like, you can't teach the kids you don't know. But I think it's also about pushing their ability to read, write, and think. And the content is just the clay that you get to play with, right? Content is just that matter. But what you're really arming your students with are the tools that they're going to apply to that matter and shape it in the way that fits their lives, fits their goals, fits their experiences. So I think that's really, really awesome that you picked up on that. We are managers of complexities. I use that phrase a lot in this chapter, and we make really important and on the feet game time decisions that shape the experience of learning for our students. And that work has a lot of complexity in it. How do you scaffold activities? In which order do those activities come in? How will you address a specific, how well do you know your kids to be able to address specific needs of specific students by adapting specific activities? Like, if that stuff doesn't get you going, if that doesn't excite you, and if you're just in it for the content, like, I feel like you're not going to be that happy. But if you are like, teaching and learning are complex activities, and I want to unlock how those things work in the real world, in real time, in front of 33 sleepy students, then, man, you can get in a better game than teaching. Like, you will never be bored. You will never, you will never run out of things to try. You will never run out of things to overcome or surmount. And that's what keeps me coming back to the classroom, right?
That's fantastic. I totally agree. And as I said, that idea of how I entered the classroom and then how I found joy in it was very similar to yours. It totally resonated with me. The change from a focus on content to the focus on how does learning happen and what's my role in that. You're right. You are never going to run out of problems to solve. You're never going to be bored.
Yeah, because no matter how good your game is, you have one or two kids who are, like, checking out. And, like, how do you get them? And then how do you also keep the ones that are already in it? And how do you get the kids who have already mastered what you're trying to do? How do you push their thinking? Man, it never gets old, and that's what's amazing. But you have to have a deep love, and you have to have a deep care for wanting to know how your students are experiencing learning in your classroom.
Yeah, well said, Minu. So, that we could talk a lot more about a lot of your advice about how to keep things intellectually interesting, but I think I'm going to actually move on. If we have time at the end, we'll come back to that. But I want to make sure we can hit all five big ideas from the book. So the next one is listen to yourself. You open this chapter with a Brené Brown quote: "When learning and working are dehumanized, when you no longer see us and no longer encourage our daring, or when you only see what we produce or how we perform, we disengage and turn away from the very things that the world needs from us, our talents, our ideas, and our passion." I thought that was a lovely opening. And this chapter really is a lot about the fears, which is also what groundwork is about, the fears that keep us from accomplishing great things. In your experience, Mino, what are some common fears that hold teachers back?
I don't think it's uncommon that teachers face fears. And I don't want to get into a larger, like, political dialogue here. I don't think we have time for that. But, I mean, when your livelihood is attached to arbitrary test scores, And your, whether you will have a job or not, or whether your school will even exist or not, is attached to standardized test scores that may or may not be fair for all students who are taking those tests. I think it's natural that teachers are feeling a lot of, a great deal of fear in their lives. But I think bringing that down, you know, walking away from that for a second, I feel like we have fear of failure and rejection, right? I think the deepest fear that teachers face is what you're doing in the classroom with your students is not making a difference in their lives or in their learning, or that it's pointless. I think that's the deepest fear that we all have. Because we work with students who can immediately give us feedback on when things are working and when they're not working, I feel like we're always on that edge of like, oh God, like this is not gonna resonate at all with my kids. And I think it also makes us like re-examine our practice over and over again, but I think that fear is there. I think we face fear of criticism from colleagues, we face fears of being punished if we take an unpopular stand in our learning community. We fear having to do all the work. Like if you're constantly the faculty member with all the great ideas in those meetings, everyone's going to turn to you and say, well, I guess you have it all figured out. Why don't you just do it? I think we face that fear. And I think going from fear to like empowering yourself and doing the things that you believe to be true about teaching and learning, I think transforms, practice. And I think, again, brings joy and energy to your work. Because if you're living in a constant state of fear, you're not going to, like that Brené Brown quote says, the world around you is going to miss out on the things that you have to offer.
So that's why it's important to overcome fear, but those are all felt like, you know, really realistic and troubling fears for teachers. So what advice do you give to somebody who's kind of, you know, locked into a fear that they can't seem to overcome, one of these fears?
So, you know, like, I make a point to say this in the introduction to the book, that this book, you know, and what it suggests is not panacea, that this is not like one solution fits all approach. This is not, you know, teaching like a champion, you know, list of like, hey, if you do this, you'll teach like a champion. This is not that. I think this chapter more than anything is about finding your inner voice and what you wholeheartedly believe about teaching and learning and aligning that to your practice. So, for example, one of the examples I give of this is from Katie McKay, who is a writing project teacher consultant. She wanted to offer students an authentic audience for the writing that they were doing in her class. And because there was such a focus on standardized testing and meeting these very limited points of what it meant to be a writer according to the district and the school standard, she felt like pressure that the writer's cafe that she wanted to do in her classroom would not work in that environment. So she found a community space where she created this like celebration of writing for her students, where she gave them opportunity to publicly share their work and invited community members and parents and friends of the students who come and be part of this celebration. And was it a perfect solution to the challenges that she was facing around what it meant to be a writer in her classroom? No, but I think what she says is she, you know, empowered the students to see themselves as writers in a larger sense of the word and in the community sense of the word. How you can creatively carve out a space between mandates and authentic practice. And this dance that we do every day around those limits, those challenges are worth taking on and following your gut and following your whole heart is worth the risk you take when you listen to yourself.
Minu, I really thank you for sharing that story for a number of reasons. One is I know that you must, in Philadelphia, encounter this too. You know, I meet a lot of young teachers in my work who just feel really not aligned between their inner voice about teaching and learning and the rules or constraints of their institution. And I think this idea that work toward alignment rather than it has to be a perfect solution or you throw up your hands is really important. At the same time, I knew I was working with Katie on a project at the time that this happened, and I also, like, even reading it in your book sort of brought back these painful memories of how hard that was. I don't know. I thank you for sharing the story. I don't know if you have any other advice or any, you know, sort of gut feeling about what you would say to a young teacher who was working in a space where the constraints just felt really out of alignment with their philosophy.
I think I close the book with, you know, a series of bullet points, and one of the bullet points I say is you don't have to follow every mandate put in front of you. You know, I think when you are talking about joy and energy and ways to thrive in the classroom, I think you do have to take a bold approach to your practice, and you can't be a revolutionary, or try to be a revolutionary while sacrificing learning for your students. I think you also have to not back down and just take and follow every mandate that's put in front of you. And this chapter really is not about what happens on the outside. I think this chapter is a lot about what happens on the inside. I think if you don't know where the alignment between your values and what you believe to be true about teaching and learning, if you can't clearly articulate that, and if you can't, like, figure out that delicate dance that you have to do of balancing between that and the mandates that are put in front of you, then I think you easily break down when the tough challenges come up. But the teachers that I have observed, or the teachers that I've learned from, or the teachers that have inspired me, have this way of, they're nimble, they're quick thinkers, they find solutions out of the hardships because they have clarity around what they believe to be true, because they bring a voice of reason and wholeheartedness.
That's lovely. Thank you, Minu. Let's move on to your last bit of advice, which feels to me like probably one of the goals or values around which you align a lot of your practice, and that is this idea that your teaching is reinvigorated by empowering your students. And You say at one point in the book that our job is to leave students more curious and more courageous. What's that mean to you, Minu? What's it look like in practice?
You know, and my principal, Chris Lehman, starts every, like, first meeting of the year when the freshmen come for their, like, main orientation. They've chosen SLA. They don't know what they've gotten themselves into. And they're all sitting in the cafe, and Chris, without a microphone, like, booms out this, like, welcoming speech for the parents that still gives me, like, goosebumps year after year. One of the first things he says is, thank you for letting us teach your kids. Like, thank you for choosing SLA. Thank you for choosing us. And I think when you have that stance that the parents of your school community have given you access to their most valuable, you know, person in the world, it humbles you, right? It humbles you to do the work that you do. For me, that's what that statement means. I realize that a privilege and an honor and a huge responsibility to teach my kids, not just, like, you know, what does the green light mean and the Great Gatsby at the end of the dock, not just, like, that symbol, but, like, what is the American dream? Do I have access to it? Do you have access to it? Does the middle class still exist in America? Like, I have the responsibility to make my students more curious, more courageous, and more of critical thinkers about the world and the world around them, to borrow a phrase from Paulo Freire. So that's what that phrase means to me, that the parents in my community have entrusted me with their children, and my job is to make them amazing thinkers, so that not only can they, not just once they graduate, they can change the world, but that they can change the world right now, because we need their talents, we need their solutions, we need their amazing thinking.
That is a great entry, I think, to my next question, because I feel like, Minu, you spend a lot of time with a lot of my colleagues who are really interested in sort of connected learning principles, and also the way that living in this digitally interconnected way with so many digital tools at our fingertips has really made access to the world's problems, and solutions to the world's problems available to everyone. Do you think much, you have anything you'd like to say about the relationship of this moment in which we all live to your capacity as a teacher to empower students?
You know, I think if you are not grappling with how technology is changing not just education but everything, the way law happens, the way healthcare happens, the way we exchange information, the way that the media landscape is changing, then, like, I feel like you're not paying attention, right? Like, I think every industry, from New York Times, you know, are we going to have a paywall or not? Like, every industry is trying to figure out, like, how is technology changing our game? And I feel like we should be doing that. And I feel like teachers are doing that. I think that's why more and more teachers are joining networks, are trying to connect with other teachers and learn from each other. I feel like we're all trying to figure out, how does my teaching change if the questions that I'm asking in my class can be answered by Siri on my student's phone? You know, like, what kind of questions should I be asking that Siri can't answer, on the iPhone that, you know, almost all of my students carry? Like,
right.
What kind of questions are worth taking on as a learning community. So it's no longer about, like, you know, asking the questions that my kids don't know the answer to. They'll just Google the answer and they'll figure it out. But it's more about what questions are shaping and transforming our society, and what questions are much more difficult to answer that we should take on together. So one quick example of this is my kids and I produced a teen magazine this past quarter. And it's a much longer conversation, but one like little thing that like made my day was when my kids were presenting about the project, and without any prompting, like all on their own, one of the slides that they had, one of the groups had the slide, and the questions on the slides were like, you know, what does it mean to be a teen? What do teens care about? I think that was the question that got me. What do teens care about? They said that that's the question that they needed to know, and that's the question that they tried to answer when they produced a teen magazine as a class. And I think that captures it, right? That's a rich question. What landscape do teens live and travel in these days? Mm-hmm. My kids explore that idea and produce articles about music, about sleep, about stress, about time management. And to me, that's rich learning because they're asking a rich question.
That's a lovely example. Thank you, Minu. We are down unbelievably to our last 5 minutes, so I want to ask you one more question, which in a way is about my impression, the way I was left having read this book. So I felt like this book offered, I know you would probably not like this roadmap, but it offers great advice for craft satisfying and fulfilling life and career as a teacher. But I also think that it asks a lot of the reader. I think this book sort of demands that we each take a leadership role in our profession by mentoring and supporting others, by making our work public. And you refer to this as an effort to restore respect for our profession and recognize the complexity of the craft of teaching. Can you say a few words about this, which is definitely my impression of what you're asking of everyone who picks up this book?
I believe that teachers have immense talent and immense level of expertise that sometimes goes untapped. And when we come out of our rooms, when we come out of our fears, when we go public with our work, when we share our work, we not only benefit from that experience because we'll get a different perspective on it or we'll look at our own practice with new eyes, it's a tradition of mentorship, right? Like if I know how to do something, it's not only like a kind and nice thing to do, but it's my responsibility to help those that come after me. And I feel like if we have that sense of connectedness where we are in this endeavor together, I feel like we can restore respect to our practice. I feel like we can redefine what it means to be a teacher. I feel like we can present a different narrative of what it means to be a teacher. I feel like the complexity that's being left out about teaching and learning in the public discourse today, that tide can be turned if we do these things together.
That's beautifully said, you know, and I think it reinforces my belief that this book is both a how-to guide and a helper, and actually, and maybe more than any of those things, a call to action. So you know, most of our hours gone. It's been, as it always is, really lovely to talk with you. Thank you so much for the interview and the book and for all your great work with kids at FLA and in our community.
Thank you so much for this opportunity to speak with you.
So this is NWP Radio, and Minu's book will be available from Heinemann, right, Minu?
Yes.
Heinemann. From Heinemann next month, March 13th. Is that right?
That is correct.
Excellent. Okay. Minu, thanks so much for spending the hour with us. We loved it, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you so much. Thank you.